Yes, I'm Gabriela Alcalde. I am with the Kentucky Health Justice Network, and we're based out of Louisville, Kentucky, but we're actually a statewide organization. And I'm going to be talking about a program that we've developed in a collaboration with another not-for-profit that serves Latina immigrants in Louisville. Okay, so I'm just going to leave this up there while I talk a little bit about why, the sort of the rationale of why we decided to do this. Our organization was really interested in addressing the health justice aspects of all Kentuckians, but we recognize that with the growing Latino community in a new settlement state, we don't have the infrastructure necessarily to address those needs. One of the areas that we're particularly interested in is reproductive health. We recognize if you look at national statistics, there are a lot of reproductive health challenges that Latinas face in terms of low contraceptive use, high contraceptive failure, high unintended and teen pregnancy rates, higher maternal mortality rates than white women, cervical cancer rates that are higher, a rising HIV rate, and of course things such as an insurance rate and poverty. We also recognize that these reproductive health outcomes do not happen in isolation. They're really just a manifestation of generalized inequitable access to resources and opportunities in the community. So we wanted to create a program that addressed the social determinants of health, and because we're a reproductive justice organization, we felt that reproductive justice is actually very aligned with public health, which is my background, to address the needs of particularly vulnerable populations and communities of color. So I always start my presentations with definitions, and I don't know how many people are familiar with reproductive justice. It's actually been around for a couple of decades, but it hasn't been implemented as much as I would hope. Reproductive justice is considered a theory, strategy, and a practice. It's a theory in that it brings a holistic, intersectional view of the issues. I like to talk about it as taking a social justice lens when you look at reproductive health. That's sort of a very simplistic way of putting it. The strategy basically talks about tactics that connect disconnected issues and organizations. And the practice brings and infuses lived personal experience into advocacy and activism and program work. It addresses a continuum of reproductive health. So whereas a lot of reproductive health and reproductive advocacy and rights work has really focused on abortion, we focus on the rights to have children, which many communities of color have had denied to them, the rights to not have children and prevent pregnancy, including terminating pregnancy, and the right to parent the children that one has, which also is severely limited by several policies for communities of color. The factors that reproductive justice considers are race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation and identity, socioeconomic status, immigration status, age, and geographic location, and it looks at the isms, sort of the intersection of oppressions, and how all of these oppressions cannot really be considered separate from each other. So we work with other organizations around the intersections of reproductive health and domestic violence, immigration and reproductive health, environmental justice, and other areas as well. Very much like the social determinants of health framework and public health, reproductive justice is a holistic ecological approach, and we look at the contextual factors when we look at why reproductive health outcomes and conditions exist. Immigration is a key aspect of reproductive justice, and it was integrated early on in that framework. So some of the intersections that I wanted to highlight between reproductive justice and public health and why it's so easy to integrate reproductive justice as a public health tool, our focus on root causes and social context, our social justice as foundation for both, the fact that we take a population level perspective for analysis and action, we're focused on prevention. We rely on cross-disciplinary, inter-organization, and community-level collaboration. In fact, that's integral to reproductive justice as well as into public health implementation. And leadership is essential. In public health, we talk about the importance of including community in our leadership. It is becoming much more so now. Reproductive justice is much more explicit in saying that leadership has to include and should be primarily by communities of color and other historically and emerging marginalized populations. So it really, we don't represent and serve marginalized communities, but we are those communities at the leadership level as well. Further, reproductive justice begins with the community, but it also calls for government action and other entities to be involved in relieving the intersection of oppressions. Public health, obviously, is rooted in government responsibility and action as well. So a little bit about our program. It's a partnership, as I said, between two organizations. We created an 18-monthly two-hour session with foreign-born Latinas. Kentucky, most of our Latinas are foreign-born, predominantly, and a lot of very young people come. A lot of our immigrants have been in other states before, and then they come to Kentucky, which is a very different experience from being in Texas or California. We address reproductive and sexual health issues. We provide childcare. We provide food for both the children and the participants, who are all adult women. And we provide a safe space to explore assumptions. We also are a very flexible program because we are participant-led. So we ended up adding a field trip to a family planning clinic at the request of participants who weren't sure about where to go for some of the things that we were talking about. And we also have offered movie nights where different participants will host some of the other participants who are ready to have a discussion around movies, which makes it a lot easier to talk about issues when it's not on a personal level. It is by invitation in many ways. The sort of general pool from which we bring our participants are women's support groups that the woman who co-facilitates the sessions with me started many years ago. There are currently 12 support groups in Louisville. Some of them are associated with churches, some of them with community centers, some of them with apartment complexes. And it's a readiness factor. One of the women who participated explained it this way. She said, Sembradoras is not completely open. It seeks out people who are ready to participate and who want to be committed to help other women. Helping others helps ourselves. It is for ourselves. It is not an obligation. And when we talk about replicability, we also want to make sure that we understand that it is as important to replicate the way in which we do this work as the content of our modules. We are developing a curriculum, but you could implement the exact same sessions in a very hierarchical way that would not in any way have the same outcomes that we have had. So we believe that the reproductive justice, again, it's not just a theory, it is also a strategy and a practice. So our sessions consist of a brief presentation, often by the two co-facilitators. I'm one, the other one is the leader of the women's groups. We have participatory activities, some of them are icebreakers, some of them are just getting the women involved in the learning process. It's primarily participant-led, and it's very much a conversational process. We don't sit in classroom style, we sit in a circle, and the two co-facilitators don't sit together. We just sort of lose ourselves within the participants. And I would add as well that we both bring our children to the programs and they're in childcare with all of the other participants' children. And that actually has created a great deal of trust and is a very important aspect of the work we do. The key components of the work we're doing are co-learning. We go into it knowing that we will learn as much as they will, if not more. That we use evidence-based research for our presentations and for the information we bring. We bring written as well as verbal information, but we also value experiential knowledge and we respect and value the experiences that all the women bring. We value our own experiences. We share the leadership. We never volunteer anybody to do something they're not ready to do, but we do invite anybody who wants to take over a session or an activity. And we talk a lot about finding our individual and collective voice in a safe space. One of the things we do is use agreements, acuerdos, that the women developed as part of the women's support groups. So these were developed before this, but we use them at the beginning of every session. And I'm going to go over them because I think they're very important. And again, these were developed by the group of women. We ask the women to share these at the beginning of every session. Honor each other's stories by being a confidant. Do not judge myself or others. Mutual respect and support. To act and speak with transparency. To take responsibility for my actions. Speak only for myself. Listen to what others say. Ask questions. Don't assume. be aware of my own limits, commitment to nonviolence, and solidarity with social justice. And these are things that we all recommit to at every session. The themes that we cover, the 18 themes, we had an introductory session where we basically talked about what is reproductive justice. We actually asked the women to tell us what they thought it was and why they decided to join the workshop, what they hoped to get out of it. We did do also a pre-evaluation survey. We did reproductive anatomy. That was a lot of fun. We had exercise that was similar to Pin the Tail of the Donkey with a very large poster. And using humor also helps a lot. We talked about what are the different words that you have heard used for the term vagina. A lot of women actually thought that vagina was a vulgar word and they had never used it. And by the end of the session, everybody was laughing and joking about all the different terms that they had heard from their different countries. I should say women come from, the majority of women come from Mexico, but we do have some from Central and South America as well. I myself am from Peru. We have women who have very limited education and some women who have finished the equivalent of high school. Although most women are very low socioeconomic, some of them would consider themselves probably low middle class, working class. So it's a very diverse group. We talked about the menstrual cycle, birth control methods, hormonal, non-hormonal, STIs, HIV and AIDS, cancer, violence over the lifespan and how reproductive health is a part of that, human trafficking and prostitution, accepting ourselves and others, physical and mental self-care, and we actually had bilingual therapists come for some of these. We invited people from the community when it was appropriate and when they were bilingual. Mental health, how to talk to your children about sexuality, which was something they were very, very interested in. Fertility and infertility and pregnancy loss. Sexual orientation, abortion as a reproductive justice issue in the immigrant community. And the closing session where we basically talked about everything we had gone through and what impact it had had on ourselves. In terms of evaluation, we did conduct a pre and post survey test. We also added an additional survey at the end of the session to ask them what they thought about the content and the format. Our evaluators, who are external evaluators, also interviewed a few of the participants from their experiences with the program. And some of the limitations were that we had women who did not come to the first or second session. They started later. We simply asked them to do the survey before they started. But we did allow women to come in later. We also did not have everybody come to the last session. It was a very, very cold winter day. We met from 6 to 8, and I understand we did not have heat in the place where we met. but we did mail everybody those evaluations, and we have just gotten 100% response as of 2 weeks ago. So we hope to have that evaluation. Some of the preliminary findings, and this is from the interviews that were conducted, we provided an interpreter for the evaluators who were not bilingual, and we were not present. They talked to 4 participants from the group. They talked about learning about community sources. We always brought in information about existing resources, as well as bringing speakers when it was appropriate. The visit we took was to a family planning clinic, which happened to be a Planned Parenthood. So there was a lot of dispelling myths about what the type of work that Planned Parenthood does and what services are available there. They really appreciated learning how to talk about sex and reproduction with their children. They didn't feel like they hadn't gotten that from their parents, so they weren't really sure how to do that. I appreciated the accurate information and dispelling of myths, particularly around the role of males in sexuality and sexually transmitted diseases. There was a lot of misinformation in terms of that. They felt an increased commitment to their community and to themselves. They saw this group as a support network and a place where they could come and be open and be safe. They felt that it helped them with their readiness to support and help others. And it changed dynamics with husbands and partners and other family members. And some of them talked about having increased self-esteem. They also felt like they learned how to listen. We always ask them not to interrupt each other, and would interrupt someone who was taking over, because sometimes that happens. They felt like they could provide information without pressuring or judging. they talked about the importance of sharing food and celebrating holidays together. We did have a lot of celebration included in our work. They couldn't do it without childcare. We don't do anything at our organization without providing childcare. And some concrete changes. They weren't afraid of police in the street, participants becoming known in the community, and they're not afraid of that role now. Some of them specifically talked about being called by community members and being asked to help when crises came up. One woman had brought her 79-year-old mother to a few of the sessions, and she said that she felt that her mother had visibly changed after attending some of the sessions. And all the women talked about the positive impact on their families. Now, one caveat that I do want to say is that some of these changes are very challenging. Women often use the word transformation about having gone through this program. We have two women who have left a husband. We have one woman who came out as being lesbian to the group. These are not easy changes. These are huge challenges, and we don't take them lightly. So we also want to recognize that while I think our evaluators were really excited about some of these changes, leaving the primary or sole income earner in the family is not an easy thing to do, nor would we ever encourage someone to do that. We simply support them in the decisions that they make. And I would say that anytime you're going to do a project like this, you have to be prepared with community resources. You have to be able to refer women and to be committed to take the time to help them and connect them to the resources, because things like this do happen. Women talked about having a hard time with their parents or with their partners because they were challenging some of the assumptions that they had before and some of the beliefs. And this can bring a lot of problems. We do a lot of work on domestic violence, and we're very aware that sometimes challenging the status quo and beliefs about sexuality and gender roles can also bring about increased violence. So these are all things we take into account, and we hope to get a lot more information once we have all of our evaluations completed. And I believe that's... So right now we're starting our second cohort. We're developing new sessions for those who graduated. They don't want to stop meeting. They want to come together again. They said they really want to have that safe space. They want to continue to explore issues that are challenging. And that's a typo. It should say challenge beliefs with an F. Sorry about that. And they want to learn techniques and skills. They want to be better listeners. So in some ways, they're similar to promotoras. But they just see themselves as community agents of change. You know, and sembradoras means those who sow seeds. So they see themselves as sowing seeds of change within their families and their neighborhoods. So thank you. Yes.
I have a question for you. How did you select your promotoras? What qualifications?
For me?
Yes.
Oh. We work with existing promotores from throughout the regions where we have implemented this program. So it's considered an advanced training. It's not considered part of a core competencies or core training. Because what we do in California is run a network for promotores, it's very easy for us to pull from existing organizations, existing programs, and from our existing network. And so what we do is we actually ask them to fill out an application. We conduct a brief interview just to ensure that the information that they're going to obtain really will get put into practice, because it's a whole other level of learning, like logic modeling and, you know, all that budgeting. And we really want to ensure that they're ready. And like that quote said, you know, so many promotores are ready to put a project into practice. They just need to learn the steps to get there. And so we select from existing promotores that have years and years of experience of working as community health workers. Any other questions? Not just for me, right?
Okay. Diane, just wanted to congratulate you on your work.
Oh, thank you.
And I just wanted to ask you, this interesting finding that you had on the relationship between the percentage of health and the hunger, or just the
food insecurity,
and seems to be kind of a culture.
Yes.
That may be a little different, but I think it's very exciting. Do you have any ideas of why some of that relationship may exist and what could be contributed to?
I do recall that in some of the research that I was looking at, not having the psychology background that I think really needed to be there in order to explain it better in my own research. But a lot of the research seemed to attribute that just you're compensating, that in this population, specifically Latinos, you're basically compensating in your situation, and instead of necessarily admitting that you may have poor health and food insecurity, you may just perceive it differently. And so it goes into those kinds of psychological explanations of how you're compensating with your actual living situations and conditions and crises in your own life, and how then you reflect that on necessarily a questionnaire or a survey.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
I have a question for Vicki. You noted that a lot of the personal responsibility to avoid teen pregnancy falls on the young woman herself. And so I was just wondering, in your meetings with other leading organizations that are committed to addressing this topic, if they identified intervention strategies or intervention targets at the family, peer, community, or policy level, instead of a lot of the evidence-based programs that are out there that they might be implementing are sort of those individual
That was a very strong issue that came about, and as you noticed, the name of the consensus statement is Latino teen pregnancy, because we took the Latina out of it, so we wanted to make sure that, you know, make note that this is not just a girl issue, this is a boy, and in the Latino community, sometimes it's even, you know, an adult male that can be in a relationship with a young Latina. So we, there were conversations about, you know, interventions that are done. Unfortunately, not many are done targeting Latinos specifically, at least not science-based interventions. A lot of them are, you know, you can find them through gray literature. But yeah, sadly, NCLR is actually trying to work with the national campaign to move on into those other, you know, levels of influence. And there are work that promotores do across the U.S., you know, to try to educate parents how to talk to their youth. And NCLR has done some of that work in the past as well, how to bring up the topic of sexual health, you know. But yeah, it is an issue, and we're very aware of it, and that's actually one of the directions that we're planning on moving on next.
Anybody else?
Guess I have. Well, I work for OSHA, so this is not really my setting. I want you all to know that OSHA protects all workers. It doesn't matter what their status is. So if you ever have that come up, please let them know, because a lot of them think that we don't work with Homeland Security or the old INS. But how, we just recently had an election, and we have Tom Pancredo in Colorado, and thank goodness he didn't get elected, but how has that anti-immigrant rhetoric affected you guys in your work?
I'm in Kentucky. We elected Rand Paul. So.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot.
Yeah. You know, Louisville, where I live, is actually sort of the progressive beacon, but it's not a progressive city but compared to the rest of the state. And it affects everything. We work closely as I've also been part of the Hispanic Latino Coalition and advocacy around those issues. But with the police, trying to get the police to work with the Latino community and other immigrant groups to say they are not enforcing immigration. Unfortunately, there are now state level and local efforts to get sheriffs and local law enforcement to actually enforce immigration, even though it's not within their jurisdiction. So it's becoming very difficult, and we also do a lot of work with domestic violence. And it is getting very hard to honestly and to feel comfortable telling people it's okay for you to call the police, because it's not always okay in every part of Kentucky. And we have lots of issues actually with labor violations, the horse industry, a lot of undocumented immigrants, and there's sexual assault, there's all kinds of withholding of wages, and there's really nothing they can do. So the anti-immigrant sentiment is prevalent, and it's used as a leverage to say, you know, who's going to believe you? Nobody's going to do anything for you. And unfortunately, it's becoming more and more so true. So it's a big issue. But I'm glad to know that OSHA is somebody we can reach out to.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? For us, we have engaged in these discussions throughout the state of California with promotores, and really wanting to build their capacity, they themselves actually wanting to build their own capacity, so suggesting to us that we actually hold these types of forums where we talk about immigration and the anti-immigrant sentiment and how to actually organize around those issues. And that's very specific to certain regions, but I think for the most part it's, they say in Spanish, tomar los cuernos, you know? You know, you want to take hold of this issue and really do something about it, and at least talk about it, and then be able to learn how to protect the communities that we're working with, because, you know, we're vulnerable, and many people don't want to stand up for their rights, or even don't know that they have those rights. And so for us, it's really trying to build the capacity of promotores to demand those rights be respected. Yeah. Yes?
For Ms. Cardoza, I'm curious about to what extent the national consensus statement addresses the social determinants, and to what extent it, you know, that you have in fact found effective and sustainable strategies to address teen pregnancy through the social determinants.
Well, like I was saying, that's part of the next steps that we're taking with the national campaign. We're actually meeting with all of the signatories. We're scheduling interviews, or not interviews, but just conversations with them to really see how, you know, we can take this further and not just leave this on a piece of paper. The national consensus, when you see it, if you go on the web, or either our website or the national campaign, it has 5 key points. And it addresses, you know, creating a safe environment for youth, promoting sexual health education, comprehensive and culturally competent sexual health for education for youth and their parents and adults, and being able to provide services and guide, you know, Latino youth parents to these services. Sort of a, you know, it's a social ecological framework in that we're not just going to tell people what they should be doing, but we're actually going to try to facilitate these things for them. And of course, it involves a lot of work. NCLR does a lot of work in terms of advocacy and, you know, facilitating services. So, you know, we're collaborating with Planned Parenthood. You know, it's just, it's such a beautiful thing, because we're actually trying to see what resources we all have to kind of put all of these out there for the community and say, well, if you're a public health leader, this is what you can do. If you're an individual in your community and want to make a change, this is what you can do. This is where you can go, and they're sure to offer you the services or the resources you need. So in that aspect, we're trying not to just tell youth, you know, don't have sex or, you know, use birth control, but more like, if this happens, this is what you should do. Or not just that, but also focus on the long-term goals for youth. We're incorporating a lot of youth empowerment organizations that, you know, research shows that if you give youth a long-term goal, like if they, you know, achieve these achievable dreams for their, you know, education, their families, they're more likely to not engage in sexually risky behavior. So those are all of like the social determinants that we're trying to address, and not just focus on, you know, not having sex, abstinence, or birth control, but just looking at the whole picture and really trying to shift the way the community and the national focus on this and say, well, these are the strengths of the Latino community. How can we change our cultural factors into something that's positive?
There's also a lot of emerging research around the intersections of intimate partner violence and among youth and teen pregnancy. So a lot of pregnancy intentions on the side of abusive partners, even as youth or adult males with teen girls. So there's a lot of, I think, as far as intersections and social determinants of health, there's a need to also look beyond the self-determination, because a lot of women, especially young women, do not have self-determination whether they get pregnant or even have sex or not. So I think that's also a really important direction, especially with Latino youth, especially if they are low income or undocumented.
Sure. Any other questions? If not, thank you very much. Oh yeah, thank you very much. Thank you.